ticklish business any way you look at it. Come on, we'll stick together.
It's Ticklish Business, the podcast devoted to honoring and deconstructing the world of classic cinema. As always, I'm your host, Kristen Lopez. This week, we return with classic film blogger Diana Bosch to honor TCM's Star of the Month, Natalie Wood, and her 1961 film, Splendor in the Grass.
This is Natalie Wood. Maybe you don't recognize her. That's probably because you've never seen her like this before.
May I please be...
This is Warren Beatty. He starred on Broadway. This is his first movie role. You won't forget him.
I really want should be a big help
but
to me, Dad.
I spent my whole life trying to create a place of importance for you in this world, and then you come home and tell me you don't want to go to college, you want to marry someone
who's girl. It's what I want to count.
This is a love story unlike any other. Its title, Splendor in the Grass.
Directed by the legendary Elia Kazan, Splendor in the Grass takes its name from the William Wordsworth poem Ode, Intimation of Immortality, specifically the part, though nothing can bring back the hour of splendor in the grass, of glory in the flower, we will grieve not, rather find strength in what remains behind. Taking place in 1928 Kansas, we follow the revved-up teens Deanie Loomis, played by Natalie Wood, and Bud Stamper, played by Warren Beatty. The two are hopelessly in love, but receive mixed messages from their parents regarding sex. Deanie, more than Bud, finds that navigating the world of good girls and bad isn't good for her mental health, and that nothing can bring back the hour of splendor in the grass.
Deanie, tell me, what's been the matter the past few days? Is it all on account of, because of Bud? Because he doesn't call for you anymore?
I don't know, Mom.
I have a mind to call that boy and tell him.
Don't you dare! Don't you dare, Mom!
Oh, don't you dare! Don't you dare!
Hold on!
Had anything serious happened? Did he... Did he spoil me?
No, Mom! I'm not spoiled, Mom! I'm just as fresh and I'm virginal like the day I was born, Mom!
Stop it!
I'm a lovely virginal creature, one thing to be
spoiled, darling! Stop it again!
A good little girl! I've always done everything Daddy and Mommy told me! I've obeyed her!
Splendor in the Grass was written by playwright William Inge, who wrote the original shows Bus Stop, Picnic, and Come Back Little Sheba. Splendor in the Grass was his first turn as a screenwriter for film, having previously worked in television after leaving the stage. Inge wrote the film first as a novel, based on real people he knew while growing up in Kansas in the 1920s. He pitched it to Kazan in 1957, when the two worked on an adaptation of Inge's The Dark at the Top of the Stairs. Inge's play version of Splendor, entitled Glory in the Flower, was fairly different from the finished product. Deanie and Bud weren't high school lovers, but a middle-aged former couple who meet briefly after years of estrangement. Inge's previous works are all sexually charged, and if you've watched Picnic, then you know what I mean. And the film's changes brought the movie to the attention of the Catholic Legion of Decency, who forced various production changes on Inge and Kazan, particularly regarding a scene that I just played a clip from, where a nude Natalie Wood goes into the hallway from her bathroom. Regardless, Inge's blend of real-life teen angst and honesty about sex remains very relevant today.
Deanie, honey, do you think you still love him? Nothing can bring back the hour of splendor in the grass, glory in the flower. We will grieve not, rather find strength in what remains behind.
Unlike Unlike Natalie Wood's previous teenage-centric role in Rebel Without a Cause, Elia Kazan didn't actually cast teenagers as his leads. She was 22, while Warren Beatty was 23. However, he surrounded the duo with actual teenagers, including Sandy Dennis in her big-screen debut. Warren Beatty was considered a bit of a snob and didn't really endear himself to the cast, but this was a different role for Natalie Wood. Though Rebel Without a Cause gave her career a much-needed shove in a new direction, she hadn't done much of substance in the 6 years since. She was still playing the girl in Tab Hunter movies, and in significant works like The Searchers, she wasn't actually the main character. Deanie Lumis was an actual woman with sexual desires, something Wood hadn't prayed previously. Her scenes with Beatty are especially sexy, complete with the first on-screen French kiss, so it wasn't surprising that the two ended up dating during production, which only makes their scenes all the better. The finished product received critical acclaim and won an Oscar for William Inge's screenplay. Natalie Wood was nominated for Best Actress, but lost to Sophia Loren in Two Women. Elia Kazan was nominated for a Directors Guild Award, but lost to Jerome Robbins and Robert Wise for the other Natalie Wood film that was out that year, a little film called West Side Story. Yes, 1961 was a banner year for Natalie Wood, one that actually propelled her into serious dramatic works and left her a lasting legacy that endures today. Today, I'm talking with Diana Bosch. Diana, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Hi, my name is Diana Bosch, and for those who don't know me, I'm on Twitter at CinemaIsSwell, and I run the blog called Flicking Out. I really became fascinated with classic movies when I was super young. The first one I remember is The Wizard of Oz, and I was just hooked. I think I was like 4 years old. American Movie Classics before Turner Classic Movies, because I'm a little bit older, that was my go-to outlet, and I've just been obsessed ever since. My favorites have a particular affinity for Audrey Hepburn and William Holden and Alfred Hitchcock and Billy Wilder movies. So excited to be joining Kristen today because we've met through TCM Party and Twitter, and she is just awesome, and I'm so happy with what she's been doing with Ticklish Business. It's great.
Well, when did you first see Splendor in the Glass, and how did that first viewing make you feel?
I remember seeing it in freshman year of college because I remember having a conversation with a classmate of mine who saw it our senior year and was like, oh, it's garbage. I saw the preview of it and it was young Warren Beatty. And I was, oh my God, that's Warren Beatty. That's what he looked like. I could not believe it. And when you see him, I mean, he could do anything. You're hooked. And I remember Natalie Wood through Rebel Without a Cause there and Miracle on 34th Street. And I was just like, I can't believe this is the same person. So I remember watching it and just so many tears. Oh my God. I could not believe this movie. It's so tragic. I'll never forget the scene where she goes back to the dance and has that big moment where she's trying to get Bud back, and that ultimately leads to her collapse. I just remember being so emotionally involved and just so sad the rest of the day when the film was done with. It stuck with me. Every time I watch it, I have to prepare myself. I have to have a conversation with myself. Do you really want to go through this evening? Because it's a wallop.
It's interesting that this is an educational film for people who discover it, because I watched this in high school during a film class, and I'd never heard of it, and I'd never seen it, and it's one of the landmark films I consider for what interested me in classic cinema. And you're totally right. It's an emotionally packed film. Just rewatching it for this podcast, I was steeling myself in order to process it, because the happy ending is a bit muted in this movie. There aren't really winners, but at the same time, Natalie Wood and Warren Beatty are just fantastic in this film. And I think this is the first time I'd ever seen Warren Beatty in a movie. For me, it's him and Robert Redford. You don't really know how to process men who look like them. Beatty and Wood's chemistry is just fantastic, and it anchors you throughout this movie. I know that you can say with any romance that you want the characters to get together by the end, but in this film, that is so necessary just for their mental health that when it doesn't happen, you're just emotionally devastated. I don't know any other movie. I'm sure other people could point out certain films that have kept me this emotionally invested in whether two characters end up together.
And with Warren Beatty and Natalie Wood, they're so beautiful. They're, to me, my ultimate ship. I want them to be together forever in real life.
They did date during production. Supposedly, Warren Beatty dated Natalie Wood's sister, Lana, for a long time after this movie had been made. Supposedly, he didn't really care when Natalie Wood died. Again, according to Lana Wood.
Chuck Eggs and Wagner did a movie that was produced by Warren Beatty, and she said that he cared so much. And then there's also reports that they were still good friends after that. He attended her second wedding to Richard Gregson. So we'll never know, because Warren Beatty is very secluded. But
if you listen to the intro, I mentioned that this was a game changer for her. Previously, she had played the child in her child acting days. She had done about 5 or 6 years of just playing the girl in Tab Hunter movies. Even though Rebel Without a Cause had reinvigorated her image in terms of making her a teenager with sexual desires, she had fallen back into playing the daughter. Even in something like The Searchers, where she's the niece that has to be rescued, she was never really a significant character. I think this film, more than the others, really cemented this idea that Natalie Wood had grown up. I mean, she's nude in this movie. Her and Warren Beatty, they have the first on-screen French kiss in this film. So it was really going to be hard, I think, to put the genie back in that bottle after this film came out.
We owe so much credit to Elia Kazan, who took a chance on her, because he said that she was this washed-up child star in the beginning and then met with her, and that's when he decided this is the girl. He saw her vulnerability and knew that there was something there and that she could pull it off, whereas Hollywood directors just weren't looking at her for anything.
What Kazan really did well is, I think what works really well here is, you're almost watching Natalie Wood's career in microcosm. It's almost like a commentary of her career, because she starts out, her mother especially, she's this small child that doesn't need to know about sex, and she doesn't need any of the tools that would make her able to navigate this very heady romance. And then you watch her go through the rebellious stage, especially in the third act that we had seen with Rebel Without a Cause, until finally, at the end, she is this quiet adult who's able to differentiate between fantasy and reality and lust and love. So I could be totally off base with whether that was intentional from Kazan's or William Inge's point of view, but I think it's really fun watching this in terms of where Natalie Wood's career had come and where
it was going
to go.
And to me, it's her finest hour. And I think if she didn't have Splendor in the Grass, we would have never known just how good and capable she was as an actress. This really showed what she can do and led to West Side Story, Gypsy, Bob and Carol Tuttle Alice, Daisy Clover, Love with a Proper Stranger. All those films, while they're not as well known, they really showed an incredible range versus The Little Kid in Miracle on 34th Street.
Only on TCM will you find the Natalie Wood deep cuts, that era from like 55 to 61, which I consider the lost Natalie Wood years, because she's not really a focal point in those movies at all. I think most people really recall Natalie Wood from stuff post-1961, and it's amazing to think that she was in both this and West Side Story
in
the same year.
When you think of ultimate love stories, heartbreaks, those two movies are it, and they star the same woman. That's incredible.
Let's talk about sex, because that's all this movie really is. It's about the concept of who's having sex, who wants to have sex. What happens when you don't have sex? When people ask me to describe this movie, I always sum it up as, sex makes you crazy. Even though it's made in 61 and it's set in 28, it's still very on the nose with the double standards regarding sexuality and what makes a good girl versus a bad girl. And I love that conversation that Natalie Wood has with her mother. She asks her mom, well, didn't you ever have those feelings about dad? And she says, no, we didn't touch until marriage. And then I just kind of let him do what he wanted, because that's what a girl does. And they don't enjoy those things. They just
every time I
children.
See that scene, I'm horrified, because
it's really speaking to something I think we see in films today, but not to that kind of a pointed degree, because, yeah, The double standards regarding sexual women is still a part of our society, and the movie is pretty open about the fact that Natalie Wood's character wants to get down with Warren Beatty. I mean, it opens with a rushing waterfall and all these emotions. She wants to do it, but what do you do when society's telling you you are a horrible person if you are? Whereas at the same time, Bud's dad is like, yeah, if you want to do that, you totally can, but just don't ruin a nice girl. I love how Kazan and William Inge, especially the playwright, who had focused on sex in so many of his movies like Picnic, really breaks down the conflicting messages that young men and young women get regarding
sexuality. It's so effective because a lot of people will say it's cliche, but it is very true. The conversations Dini has with her mother, Bud has with his dad, I feel are ones that you will still see in middle America today. One of the striking moments of the film is when you see them go into the parlor of her home and it starts getting very intense between them. He pushes her to the floor and makes her declare that she would do anything for him. And it's such a great moment between the two acting-wise. Obviously, for the audience, it's very uncomfortable and horrific in a way. But the way these two actors did it, they were so vulnerable and sensitive in that moment with all these feelings. You can see Bud, he's losing it, and she is so confused and scared. You can see it in her eyes, and that's one of the great things about Natalie Wood. She was such a good actress in conveying so much emotion in her face. She has the moment where she's like, I actually would do anything for him. That
you brought up that scene in the parlor where it becomes very questionable in terms of consent. Because they're having this moment that's very romantic, and Warren Beatty is just adorable. And all of a sudden, he just starts thinking, she's kind of a doormat. He shoves her down and makes her declare that she'd do anything for him and that she's his slave. And you start to get very uncomfortable. There are moments in the movie where rape, I think, is implied in this scene, even though it doesn't happen. You are meant to believe that a line has been crossed, which ends up culminating in the third act at the dance when Dini goes to the dance with Toot. He tries to attack her in the car because she's thinking that if she has sex with somebody, either she won't feel this way about Bud or that Bud will get jealous. It leads to these real life questions that in 61, I mean, somebody can tell me, you know, more explicitly, but I don't think rape was at all expressed in America as or in cinema. I mean, really, the only one I know is Ida Lupino did Outrage. This is a big, glossy Hollywood picture with two A-list stars, and a lot of rape moments, or at least rape-esque moments, where you have to wonder how much of Dini's psyche is from the fact that she wants to have sex, and the fact that she's got some trauma from the men in her
life. I think
life.
It goes back to what the playwright and Kazan were after, which was saying these are things that are happening. Kazan especially were touching on themes that people were afraid to tackle in on the waterfront, standing up to corruption, East of Eden. All of these were very heavy films. And it was ushering an interesting era in Hollywood because to go from post-war where everything's great, America, but things are happening in these small communities that people are dealing with real issues.
You bring up the fact that, yeah, there were these things going on in American households well before this. As the code starts breaking down as the 60s progress, you see a lot of these soapy melodramas, and I think Splendor in the Grass starts this off with these soapy melodramas about poor teens stuck on the wheel, you know, small town America. They want to have sex. What do they do? And I think Splendor in the Grass takes that material seriously. In the coming year, you got Lolita in 1962. You got Peyton Place in 64. They were taking those melodramatic elements that you saw in stuff like Douglas Sirk films and were reappropriating it to this teenage audience that Hollywood knew would go see these movies. Teens are very confused by what adults are telling them to want. And what does that mean in a country where teens are told that they should aspire to marriage, but we're just coming out of the war? We would enter another war with Vietnam in the next couple of years, which was filled with young teens out of high school. So you have this liminal stage where teenagers are being torn in two different directions between wanting to be individuals, but wanting to fit into societal expectations. And what does that mean? And Kazan really taps into something that I don't think a lot of other movies were focusing on with any amount of
seriousness. I feel like this film actually looks at teenagers as people. Seeing what's going on through their eyes really makes a difference. And it's interesting because
you also have the concept that it's 28. We're dealing with post-war and heading into Brave New Era of the 60s. But at the same time, this movie is showing the end of an era right before the Depression and the end of the flapper, which was this time period of hedonism and women were able to do what they wanted and they could have sex. And it's pretty much saying that that time period is dead and gone. I like Natalie Wood's story. Deanie's story, I always feel, is more timeless than Bud's, because his father loses all his money in the Depression and his sister Jeannie is a flapper, and yes, he's being torn in this concept of wanting to show his feelings and he wants to be in love, but he also wants to get laid. Deanie's story is timeless because not a lot has changed in terms of, yes, women have gotten better at being able to choose what they want to do with their bodies and get better jobs and, hell, even run for president. But at the same time, what does it mean when a girl's had not enough sex or too much? That element, more than anything, still
I also
resonates.
Think there's another element to Deanie that we see when she sees Bud at the end. She realizes that she is much more than him. When we see her so in love, she's writing her name and his name in a notebook. She is so devoted. This is it. Within her unraveling, she becomes her own person. And I think that's, we see that transformation. And at the end, that's what makes it bittersweet, but ultimately beautiful when you see it through her eyes.
This could have really turned into a weird film where we watch the female pine over Warren Beatty's character for the entire movie. And you're right. It's why I feel Natalie Wood's story is the better of the two, because you do see this dramatic shift. You see her go from this pie-eyed teenage girl who's willing to be late to class because of her boyfriend.
She kisses him every night through photos. She's in love.
She goes through the gamut. She ends up having a mental breakdown, which at that point, I really thought, okay, this movie's just gonna go for the cheap shocks about ladies and lust and the bad things that it does to your head and it drives you crazy. But at the end, she really realizes stuff that I didn't anticipate. And I want to bring up the similarities to Rebel Without a Cause and some of the other 1950s films that had come out around this time, because Natalie Wood had played the role of Judy, which was the red-lipped girl that Jim Stark, James Dean's character, is in love with, and she's got this weird relationship with her dad that you don't really understand if it's her need for affection or if there's something criminal going on between them. And it's fun to place these two characters, Deanie and Judy, together, because I think there's a lot of similarities there.
There are some similarities to there. I even think you could say, even in an alternate universe, this could have happened.
Both of them are high school characters who want to fit in, whether it's society or whether it's their clique of friends. Judy, I think, is a bit more of a closed character than Deanie because of that ending. Rebel Without a Cause is, for all its talk about rebellion, really, the kids just want domesticity. I mean, the end of Rebel Without a Cause is the family unit of Jim and Judy and Plato finding their own world of happy marriage, happy children, and realizing that the adults could threaten to tear that apart. Whereas Splendor in the Grass is saying, marriage and family's all great, but you need to know yourself first. And I think that's where Natalie Wood's character at the end really shines through. Yeah, Judy could have been where the Deanie character went. She's so pent up for sex that she's trying to solicit it from, like, any guy that will come up to her. But really, I think it's why I say that the material is dealt with seriousness, because the movie's saying love is great, but it's not the end-all be-all of your personality. It's not what makes you you.
And it also shows us that no one has a clear path. Deanie was being groomed to marry Bud, and that obviously didn't happen. It's like self-discovery just continues, which with the end of Rebel Without a Cause, I feel like the tragic thing that happens there, it's like, what's next? These kids are going to pick up the pieces because they found each other finally, which is what they were looking for.
And I think both this and Rebel Without a Cause say, parents, you're horrible. The parents in this movie are just so wrapped up in living through their children. Deanie's mother is so desperate for wealth, and that comes from wanting to marry off her daughter. And Bud's dad, who is played by Pat Hingle, who's great, is so consumed with leaving a legacy through his kid. He's already cast aside his daughter because he considers her both a bad girl and the fact that she's a female, so she can't inherit anything of substance. Both sets of parents really are just consumed with bettering themselves through their kids, and I think that's where all the problems happen.
It feels like a trope, but then when you look at things in your own lives, every parent kind of does that because it's wanting what's best for your kid, and parenting is hard. When you watch it, yeah, they're horrible, but you can understand in a way, especially like Deanie's mom, she's looking out for her, even though I put her in my list of top 10 worst mothers in history of film. But still, like, you can tell she really, that's her little girl.
All the characters, I think, are written about as well as they can be. Even Deanie's friends, one of whom is played by Sandy Dennis, are written very authentically. I love that the movie doesn't have this big glossy color palette, even though 61, we had Technicolor and all of that. It's a very muted color scheme. The characters aren't dressed in any frippery or finery. The housing is very gray, very drab. It's not Rebel Without a Cause in terms of those bright shocks of color, unless you want to count Natalie Wood's dress at the end at the dance. A lot of the transitions and the changes come from things that seem very simple. Deanie cutting her hair, especially if you've seen something like Little Women, the transition from girl to woman involves cutting of the hair, but it also connects to the flapper era. Kazan really sets the stage for this world where the haves and the have-nots really look the same.
What you see is something that you could have put what Deanie goes through and put it in New York City or somewhere like this, because her story's universal.
West Side Story looks more opulent than this movie, and that is set in New York City. I do want to bring up my third favorite character next to our leads, which is Barbara Loden, who plays Ginny, Warren Beatty's sister in the movie. And Barbara Loden actually was dating Ilya Kazan at the time. They got married eventually. I think they were together until she died. And Barbara Loden ended up becoming a director. She's really great in this movie. Again, a character that could have been this loud-talking, gum-chewing annoyance that is the poster child for what Deanie's life could be like if she doesn't choose the right path. But Ginny is desperate for a reaction, and not really a reaction from herself. When I say similarities to Rebel Without a Cause, I see Ginny as having a lot of similarities with Judy, both wanting to please their fathers, both wanting to make something of themselves. And the movie doesn't give Ginny this happy ending. It just reiterates that she's going to make the same mistakes until something happens. We're not really sure what that something is.
Ginny, I feel for her, because every scene you see her is she clearly lost. And speaking of a comparison to Judy, she also has a very weird relationship with her father, where it's very uncomfortable. This is a woman who was ahead of her time because society wouldn't allow her to just be. And she struggled with that throughout the whole film. And ultimately, it ends in her demise, which is so sad. You hear Deanie's mother, of course, blame her for her own demise, which is so sad. And watching her is hard, too, because she's slut-shamed all over the place. You feel for her because, again, society wouldn't let this woman live.
This is slut-shaming the movie. There is so much shame that just comes from Deanie's decisions or her lack of decisions. I mean, it's why Natalie Wood acts so well in this movie, because she is taking criticism from literally all angles. She's criticized for not wanting to go all the way, so Bud doesn't want to talk to her, he doesn't want to see her. Her mom wants her to stay chaste and pure, but then when Bud doesn't want to be with her, well, obviously she's doing something wrong. It's easy to see why she would just want to, A, lose her virginity, get rid of it, and why she would want to drown herself. I can feel for Natalie Wood in that one scene, because if you are a Natalie Wood fan, she was not a fan of water. She did not want to do that scene at all, and she did it. And I think you can see the fear, very evident, not just the fear of the character, but Natalie Wood's own fear at having to go in that water and swim and pretend to drown and then try to save herself. Even when she's in the mental institution, she's still getting her mother's criticism. She's gonna be fine soon, she's gonna be home, and that everything's gonna be okay. And you want her to be able to go to a place where nobody knows her and just take a breath.
The hospital scene is one of the most heartbreaking for me, especially in the moment where Bud goes in there and the nurse tells her that he was never there, which ultimately ruins the course of these two ever being together, because she believes that he never cared and he did. And when he leaves and cries in the waiting room, it's just so heartbreaking, because you just know that this couple is never going to be the same. We see her begin to break down, hit her point where she fights back at her mom in the bathtub. And this is a famous scene, the one that everyone says got her the Oscar nomination. It's interesting if you watch it and know Natalie Wood's own story with her mother, who was just as much of a horror as the character Deanie's mom was. So in that moment where she kind of has this rebellion against the mother, goes pretty crazy because she just can't handle the pressures of this anymore and the breakup with Bud. It's just a really powerful moment, knowing her backstory and then, you know, what was happening in that scene. And I believe it was the only take that they did.
That bathtub scene is amazing. And I think it's a moment that Natalie Wood tried to recapture a couple times. If you watch the breakdown in Inside Daisy Clover, where she's in the recording booth, she's completely stripped bare. She's in this bathtub and her mother just keeps hounding her, and she finally just snaps and she keeps saying, I'm not spoiled. He didn't spoil me. That moment is just this culmination of everything this character has wanted to say and everything that I think she was kind of hoping for. She wants to be spoiled by Bud. The deterioration of that character just kind of comes to a head, and Natalie Wood sells the hell out of it. That is a brilliant moment.
It really is. I feel like in other films, very melodramatic movies, it could go over the top.
It would have been very campy.
I appreciate that scene because there's no crazy music until after, where the door shuts and the mother calls for the father. So it's just very quiet and it's what it is. But again, it just comes back to Natalie Wood being so effective with her face. She could sell her emotions in that moment. She's so vulnerable and confused and really just reached a breaking point. And I just think it's a really beautiful scene.
Speaking of beautiful moments, let's talk about the ending, because after you've just been put through the ringer by these two characters not being together, the movie ends with Deanie coming out, finally not cured but better in her time away, and she looks like Natalie Wood. I think that it's fantastic that she starts the movie as this girl with long brown hair wearing barrettes and like a little sweater, and she comes out at the end looking like a sophisticated woman, putting that cork in the bottle of I'm Natalie Wood, the actress, not Natalie Wood, the teenager anymore. She goes to visit Bud one last time, and she realizes that he has gotten married to a waitress and has a child. And as she drives away after they've reminisced, she reiterates the Wordsworth poem about, you know, nothing can bring back the hour of splendor in the grass. Now, Inge's play, originally, as I said in the introduction, was about two middle-aged former lovers coming back together to reminisce. And I think that's probably the brunt of the original plot is brought back here at the end. But I think what we say when we say that Deanie's character is more timeless and that she learns about individuality, I think that comes through here, because Bud essentially settled. He settles for what works. And even though he's living his own life and he's not a wealthy man, I always thought that they alluded to the fact that he married this girl because she was pregnant. And maybe I'm wrong on that, but it always feels like that ending, Deanie looks at him with love, but almost like he's pathetic, because she's able to go and live a life now, and he's
stuck.
It's funny. I've heard that, and I always love TCM partying this film because there's a lot of people that are like, oh, it's so sad, and then other people are like, wow, she really dodged a bullet. He sucks. I'm so surprised because, you know, that's the beauty of film. Endings are what they are. It's hard for me because these two didn't die. Their love did. It was beyond their control, and it just shows you that life goes on, and eventually they'll be okay, but it's just, you wonder, was that their great love in life? And are they just going to have to settle for the next one? Did Bud settle, or does he really love his wife? We don't know. When they first look at each other, it's so bittersweet because you can still feel the love there. There's that great shot of Warren Beatty looking at her, kind of smiling because he's really blown away by how beautiful Natalie Wood looks in that beautiful white dress. But there's just no way this is going to work. Every time I watch it, I think, okay, well, maybe the lady leaves Bud or... But there's no way that... You try to think of scenarios that they'll be together, but there's just no way. None makes sense. In the moment where he says to her before she leaves, you've got to take what comes in life, it hurts more than anything because clearly he did. And I don't think she had any idea what was going to happen when she saw him. And in that moment, when you see her face, it like hits her that she'll be okay.
I think you're onto something when you wonder whether she kind of dodged a bullet, because most movies that deal with that first love element, you start to wonder whether they were in love because of the circumstances or if there was something else, and we're never really sure. I always wonder about how much of their relationship is the fact that they're the two best-looking people in Kansas. Based on what else we have here in this small town, the fact that you have two people that look like Natalie Wood and Warren Beatty in small-town Kansas in 1928, they should be hailed as unicorns. You start to wonder whether they were together through convenience, and we're never really sure. And I love that the ending leaves you wondering, is Deanie better off with or without Bud? I would say yes, but I'm sure somebody would say no. You know, you start to wonder, at this point, if Deanie took Bud back, would she be settling? Because he's kind of not motivated. He gets into a nice school, and he doesn't want to work hard, and he has these dreams of being a farmer.
Yeah, I always found that interesting that he flunks out of class. I always wonder, is it because he's so heartbroken because of Deanie, or does he just really not care and wants to stick it to his dad? But at the end, it's so broad every time you see moving on versus her in the sanitarium. And then he wasn't going to wait for her forever, even though she was always thinking about him. He just, for some reason, couldn't find her. It's just so sad. The moment I felt that Bud was truly heartbroken was when he meets Angelina in the Italian pizza shop. And she's, you must have a sweetheart over there. And Warren Beatty so convincingly says that he did, and his face just ultimately reverts back to heartbroken, like you see that he misses her. And that one of the main little nuggets that you get towards the end of the film where he did care. One of my favorite things to do is Google image search Warren Beatty and Natalie Wood, because they truly were the most beautiful couple I've ever seen in classic Hollywood. Sorry, Vivian Leigh, Laurence Olivier. They are just so gorgeous. I wish it worked out. I'm so happy that it's Natalie Wood month, because her career has been so tainted by her demise and certain films that aren't looked favorably now in modern eyes, like West Side Story. A lot of people just get really mad that Natalie Wood played Maria. And I don't think it's fair, because given what they were working with in the 1960s, I thought she did a very convincing performance. She's so sensitive, and I think she's a beautiful Maria, probably one of the best I've ever seen, having seen it on Broadway. Her career spanned so long. She started when she was like six. Like, that's incredible. And we're seeing so many gems of performances that I have never seen before, and that's just the beauty of TCM. But it's hard, because when you look at the films after Splendor in the Grass, there aren't that many good ones. And it hurts hearing that, because Elia Kazan and Warren Beatty definitely thought highly of her. I mean, Warren Beatty wanted her to be Bonnie in Bonnie and Clyde, which ushered in New Hollywood. And I feel like that's the biggest mistake, because who knows what she could have done with that role? And could she have been a Faye Dunaway or a Julie Christie? she was great in her own right, and I think it deserves to be celebrated.
Well, real briefly, because we have a couple of minutes, let's throw out our favorite Natalie Wood film that people should watch, because it is Natalie Wood Month. If you're a U.S. person who has TCM, I keep being reminded by people who do not live in the U.S. that they don't get the same TCM movies that we get. So, other than Splendor in the Grass, which obviously everybody should watch, I always say, I love Miracle on 34th Street. I think that Natalie Wood's side eye when she's looking at Edmund Gwenn in that movie is hilarious. Inside Daisy Clover, it's one of the post West Side Story roles, and I think she's really fun in it. She's not believable as a teenager by that point at all, because I think she was like 30, but that movie is so fun. And again, giving a run for its money, the second sexiest couple, possibly tied for first, is Natalie Wood and Robert Redford. And then I also recommend Love with the Proper Stranger. It's her and Steve McQueen. It's going to be on TCM. It's not available on DVD for some reason. Unless you have Amazon Prime and you can rent it to watch through streaming. But those are the three I always say. Definitely, you want to get a great broad look at her film career. Those are the ones to watch.
I'm really excited that Bob and Carol and Ted and Alice is coming up, because it's such an interesting take on the whole free love movement of the 60s. And you see Natalie older, you see young actors like D. Elliott Gould and Diane Cannon. It's great. And I love the dynamic between Natalie Wood and Diane Carroll, because they're just really great female roles. You know, Natalie Wood was considered old Hollywood, and here you have the new Hollywood coming in. I don't know if this Property is Condemned is playing, but it is a great one. You can find it somewhere. I know you can. Natalie Wood is a Southern girl in this one, so she has this Southern accent. And Robert Redford, and echoing Kristen's sentiments, gorgeous. You just look at them. They are wonderful. And they just have really great chemistry in the film. And it's interesting because I don't think it's one that you can easily define. I know they're airing it, The Great Race. I don't care what anyone says. I think it's so fun. Natalie Wood is just having fun in that movie, which is great, because you never really see her in comedies. I think she did like a 3.
Well, overall, what do we think about Splendor in the Grass? I say it's a classic. If you're thinking it's this soppy melodrama, it has elements of that, but I don't think it embraces that. And Natalie was fantastic.
I said this earlier, that it was her finest hour, and I really think it is. You have to see it for her and for young Warren Beatty, especially Warren Beatty, because thinking of what he's accomplished till now, it's just incredible that that's his first film, because what a great first film. Let's be real, not a lot of people get to hit it out of the park with a movie like that. He was challenged, and it shows. I think he's great in the movie. I know Kazan's controversial, but if you think of his body of work, it's just amazing. Put that against On the Waterfront and East of Eden, A Face in the Crowd. This man had a lot to say. He gave voices to so many interesting things that were happening in America.
Let me know what you think about Splendor in the Grass or the work of Natalie Wood in general. You can email your thoughts to me at ticklishbiz@gmail.com, and I will read them on the next episode. I'd like to thank once again the awesome Diana Bosch for joining me today. Once again, where can fans find and get in touch with you?
You can find me at Twitter. My handle is @cinemaiswell. My blog is Flicking Out, and you can find that. That is flickingout.wordpress.com. And you can email me at diana.bosch@gmail.com.
On Twitter, I asked my followers what their favorite Natalie Wood movie was. And before we close out, I'd like to read some of their comments. Gina D'Alfonso said that her favorite Natalie Wood movie is a toss-up between The Great Race and West Side Story. More Gooder Than said, especially at this time of year, Miracle on 34th Street. Nerds with Attitude tweeted, Rebel Without a Cause and West Side Story. Peter Gatt also said West Side Story. So thank you guys for responding to my question. Again, if you would like to send any comments or questions, or also share your favorite Natalie Wood movie quickly, you can do that via Twitter @ticklish_biz. That's going to close out this edition of Ticklish Business. You can listen to Ticklish Business a multitude of ways, either at ticklishbusiness.podbean.com, via Stitcher Radio, or on iTunes. If you listen via iTunes, please feel free to leave a rating and review. As always, you can contact me directly at ticklishbiz, that's B-I-Z, at gmail.com, or visit me at my official website, where I discuss classic films regularly at journeysinclassicfilm.com. The podcast is also now on Twitter at ticklish_biz, so if you'd like to get in touch with me directly, feel free to tweet out suggestions for future films and themes. Next time, guest Craig Risinger and I celebrate Noirvember, counting down our top three films noir. Till next time.